This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Tom Malyazzi, the beloved public radio host, died yesterday of complications related to Alzheimer's disease. He was 77. Tom and his younger brother Ray were the hosts of NPR's Car Talk, which is still broadcast in an archival version. Car Talk is popular for the car repair advice the brothers dispense, but perhaps even more popular for their comedic banter. In fact, many people tune in who don't even own a car, but just love listening to the brothers. Ray, who was 12 years younger than Tom, wrote this on the Car Talk website. "We can be happy that Tom lived the life he wanted to live, goofing off a lot, talking to you guys every week, and primarily laughing his ass off." We're going to listen back to an interview I recorded with Tom and Ray in 2001, but first, we're going to hear from Doug Berman, who has been the executive producer of Car Talk since it began on NPR in 1987. He also created NPR's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. When I spoke with Doug this morning, we started by playing back this clip from Car Talk, where Tom offers a bit of his philosophy.
I have my own law of marriage, and it is more important to be happy than to be right. Now, you may know that you're right. I mean, I'm always right. Whenever my wife and I have an argument, I'm always right. But being the clever fellow that I am, I never try to prove to her that I'm right. And she thinks that I'm a dummy because I'm always wrong. But she loves me.
Well, I'll tell you, everyone else thinks you're a dummy, too. You know, a little secret.
But see, I know, as long as I know that I'm always right, I don't have to tell her that.
Doug Berman, thank you for talking with us. I'm so sorry for your loss. You know, as a longtime producer of Car Talk, when you were making a suggestion to Tom, was he right or was he happy in his interaction with you?
It didn't matter. He was pretty uncompromising. He had a real anti-authority streak, but he did it in such a funny, nice way, you know. He hated to be told what to do. He hated to be told what to think. He sort of carefully challenged everything.
So were you the authority figure, the sometimes bad guy in the situation?
Well, I quickly learned not to be, you know. I tried a couple of times early on, and then I ended up just kind of cajoling, you know, which worked a lot better.
So as we can hear an example of in that clip, Tom was famous for his laugh. Did it make him self-conscious when people told him how much they loved his laugh?
Not at all. He laughed. I mean, it was almost a force, almost separate from him. It was always lurking, trying to come out. And, you know, he would see something funny coming, you know, a few sentences away, and he would start to laugh while he was talking. But, you know, the unique thing about him is that, you know, his view of the world was really, really positive. You know, and I think whether listeners could articulate that or not, I think they recognize that this was a guy who was pulling everyone up rather than taking everyone down. He just laughed very easily and found humor in everything.
So Tom died of complications from Alzheimer's. As his producer, did you see signs of memory loss or confusion before you knew the diagnosis?
Yeah, and he did too. And that's why we stopped recording shows in 2012. You know, he felt that he just wasn't what he used to be. And, you know, he had such an incredible mind that it was really difficult for him, you know.
So when the show went into reruns, it wasn't mentioned that he was having, that Tom was having cognitive problems. Did he and the family want to keep that quiet?
Yeah, I guess so. You know, it wasn't an explicit decision, but nobody said, you know, hey, let's talk about this. I think we just respected his privacy, you know.
Was Tom still kind of laughing and funny and with a positive outlook even as he was losing his memory?
Yeah, he still laughed. I went and saw him just last week, and I walked in, and he gave me, I can't describe it, but he gives you this look where he sort of like looks startled for a second, like it's a surprised look to see you, but it's a joke, you know? And I did the same thing back to him, and he laughed, you know? So it was still there.
That's nice to hear. So you work with Tom and with Ray. How would you describe the difference between the two brothers? Because we know them, we the listeners know them as this like unit, this like impossible to untangle unit.
They are different. I mean, they're certainly well matched, but Tom is the guy who goes off on the tangents. You know, he's the philosopher. He's the creative scientist. He's looking for correlations, connections, and deductions all the time. You know, he's the one who comes up with theories. He's a real original thinker, not at all inhibited by convention or whether something is possible or not. And Ray, we often refer to as the voice of reason in comparison. You know, Ray sort of represents reality, and Ray represents, you know, what can be and what's possible. And that was how they played off each other.
So we're about to hear an interview I recorded with Tom and Ray Meliozzi in 2001. And it's only now that I found out about something that wasn't in that interview. I had asked them how they started their first garage, and Tom said, well, he'd quit his job and was collecting unemployment insurance and came up with this idea. He neglected to tell me about this car crash that actually changed his life. Can you give us a brief description, Doug, of what happened?
Yeah, he was in his 20s. He had a 9-to-5 job that, you know, he wasn't crazy about. He was driving on a crowded Boston highway in a little tiny cheap car, which is typical of him. And he had a near miss with a truck, and it shook him up. And he went to work, and he walked in, and he quit, and he said, if I had died, I'd be really pissed.
So he wasn't hit. It was a near miss.
It was a near miss. He just, escaped an accident. But it came close enough that it made him think that it's time to do what I want to do.
You were their executive producer right from the start, from 1987, when it became an NPR show. Before that, it was a local show on BUR. And then it was a regular feature on Susan Stamberg's show when she was the host of Weekend Edition. So when you took over the show, I mean, it was your job to make it into great radio. At the same time, you wanted them, I'm sure, to sound like themselves, because that was part of the key to the show's success, that they just sounded so authentically themselves. So what advice did you give them, though, about how to change things to make it into a great national weekly show?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that the show developed through a very carefully honed strategy of benign neglect.
That sounds right in the Meliozzi spirit.
It's a strategic decision to ignore them for 10 years locally. For the first 10 years, nobody paid any attention to them, and they sort of learned to broadcast as if no one was listening, which I think, is what, how their sound came to be. They relaxed and became, completely and utterly themselves, as if no one, no one else was there. And there were no broadcast rules, no one telling them how to speak or what to do. And that's what became Car Talk, when I came in, it was simply, to me, it was a matter of, of formatting it in a way where it moved a little faster and the tangents didn't go on as long. But rather than give them advice, what I decided to do was simply record a lot of them and then edit it after the fact and simply take the best of what they did. I would speak to them, through, we have a talkback system where I could speak into their ears while they're, while they're on the air. And I would, I would ask for things that I felt like I needed to have in order to edit, if something wasn't clear, if there was a piece of information missing, I would say, explain this. Or I'd say, ask the person about this, so we have everything we need to make a coherent narrative, of each call. But really it was, the genius was theirs. They did their thing, and, they were just amazing guys and brilliant guys. And, my job was just to sort of, you know, facilitate it and then, you know, edit it into a show every week.
Doug Berman has been the executive producer of Car Talk since its start as an NPR program in 1987. We'll hear more from him later as we continue our remembrance of Tom Magliozzi, who died yesterday at the age of 77. We'll listen back to my 2001 interview with Tom and Ray Magliozzi after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Tom Magliozzi, who died yesterday at the age of 77, of complications related to Alzheimer's. Tom and his brother Ray hosted Car Talk, which has been a popular NPR show since 1987. We're going to listen back to the interview Tom and Ray recorded on Fresh Air in 2001. Tom was 12 years older than Ray. They each graduated from MIT. After Tom got his degree in chemical engineering, he worked in the marketing department of a corporation, speculating about future trends. After narrowly escaping a crash with a tractor trailer, he quit his job, abandoned the corporate life, and collected unemployment insurance. Ray moved to Vermont after graduating from MIT and taught at a middle school. Ray told me that his mother urged him to try and rescue Tom from his layabout life. So Ray returned to Boston, and Tom came up with the idea of starting a garage.
See, that was one of the things I had come up with when I was sitting at this company, speculating about the future. I had my feet up on the desk, and I put together all the different trends that I could see, and I said, you know what would be a great idea? A place where you could fix your own car, and people would have the tools for you. They'd have a lift you could put your car up on, all the tools that you would never buy yourself because you only needed them once, and they would have a roof over your head and someone to advise you. I said, what a great idea. And then I quit my job and became a bum and promptly forgot all about it.
Now, when you started the do-it-yourself garage, it seems to me the time must have really been right for that because, for example, like in 1970, I think you started the garage in 73, and around 1970, I was tuning up my own car. I mean, that's how much people were into do-it-yourself mechanics, that short-lived period in my life.
It was really an idea whose time had come. And it was...
Unfortunately, it didn't stay.
It was one of those things that you couldn't make any money at it. And, you know, it was a great concept. And we have never had as many laughs as we had the year that we opened that garage. I don't think I've ever had as many laughs as I had.
No, we had
year.
A rollicking good
we
time.
Had
what
a
kind of laughs?
Belly laughs, because we attracted... every kind of inept weirdo that the city of Cambridge and the surrounding towns had to offer.
Yeah, and there was no shortage.
There was no shortage, and I was amazed to find out how many wackos inhabited our fair city. And those who came in who thought they knew what they were doing and didn't really expected us to do the work for them for $2.50 an hour or whatever we were charging them. And we soon realized that we were doing all the work for everybody, running around like nuts, doing everyone's work while they were standing there, paying $2.50 an hour, having professionals work on their cars. It even got so bad that we had to hire extra people to help out. And while we did make some money during the days before every major holiday, it was pretty much a bust.
Yeah.
And then we hadn't figured out that the good people of Cambridge were going to steal our tools and all that. So,
oh, did they do that?
Well, yeah, but what really drove us out of business was the fact that in 1973, fixing one's own car was within the grasp of the average person. But as emission controls came into being and cars got more complicated, it soon disappeared. That ability soon disappeared. And we found that the business diminished considerably. And people in the Cambridge who had the time, because they were unemployed bums like my brother, to work on their own cars, went out and got jobs and bought newer cars and fortunately, you know, took them to us to get them serviced.
But it's interesting how much fun the bums could be. I mean, these were complete wackos, weirdos, as my brother said. He's absolutely right. But man, were they fun. And they weren't worried, you know, when the guy jacked up his Lincoln Town Car and drove the floor jack through his oil pan. Did he cry? I said, "Oh." I mean, people could take a joke. And people were not as uptight as they are now. You know, it was only a car. And what was really sort of spiritual about it was that nobody ever got hurt. I mean, in all the years that we did that, with complete rank amateurs using very dangerous equipment.
Oh, like acetylene torches.
Oh, man. I mean, lifting
and we didn't
four
know,
tons.
We really didn't know any better either. Yeah, you want to use the torch? Yeah, go ahead. We'll be standing on the other side of the brick wall.
Yeah, wear this football helmet. Call us if anything happens. We're going out for coffee.
So when the do-it-yourself concept failed financially, why did you start a real garage after that?
Well, because we had a real garage, too. In the same building.
It was sort of a gradual transition. You know, in the beginning, all the customers were doing the work themselves, ostensibly. And little by little, we found ourselves doing more and more of it. And then people would come and say, gee, I really can't do this myself. Would you guys do it? So we had professionals working in side by side with amateurs. And it just so happened that the amateurs began to disappear and the cars increased in number. And so it became just a plain old repair shop when all those crazy weirdos got jobs, I guess. I don't know where they are.
Yeah, some of them got sent back to the mothership.
Tom?
Yeah.
Tom, were you doing mechanical work yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, for many years he did.
Many years. No, I stopped doing it many years ago because it was much too much like work. and I've been trying all my life to avoid, you know, real work. And that was, I mean, in the beginning it was just so much fun that I didn't realize it was work. We were literally putting in 12, 14-hour days. And these were hard, hard days. I mean, I remember going home, plopping on the bed, falling asleep, waking up the next morning and dragging myself back to the shop. And
yeah, there weren't many days spent with your feet up on the desk.
Oh, man.
But it was fun.
When you guys started your garage, were your parents ever embarrassed to say, my sons are mechanics, as opposed to being able to say, my sons are teachers, my son is a marketing consultant?
They hung their heads in shame.
Well, they didn't really hang their heads in shame, I don't think. They just kept shaking their heads like, what are you guys doing?
Yeah, we should mention you're both graduates of MIT.
Yeah.
How about Dad that? Worked his fingers to the bone to send us there. And when we told them that we were opening up an auto repair shop, their hearts sank.
Now, the first time you were on the radio, I think it was for a panel discussion on cars on WBUR, a Boston NPR affiliate. Were you relaxed that first time on radio? Did you feel like you sounded and behaved like yourselves?
Yeah, I think so, only because we didn't know that it was a real radio station. I mean, it's part of Boston University. And at the time, the studios, I mean, you'd think it was like 1920. And
the equipment resembled the tin cans and the string that we used as kids.
And you would expect Marconi to walk by any minute. And so our assumption was, you know, first of all, who's listening to this station? And we thought it was a station that only broadcast, like, on wires within the school, within BU.
Well, we thought it had, you know, 50-watt capacity, and then we found out it had 50,000 watts. Sometime.
Well, when they turned on the microphones, the lights dimmed. So, yeah, I think we were pretty relaxed.
When you started doing your own show on WBUR, before the show was national, back in the early days when you were first starting, how did you sound compared to how you sound now, do you think?
Well, it sounded surprisingly like the new shows do.
It did?
Yeah. I mean, we tended to, if we got someone on the line who we thought was interesting, we tended to talk to that person for whatever period of time we thought was appropriate, sometimes 25 minutes. And our producer, Doug Berman, would never allow that now. He's giving us the cut sign and waving his hands and jumping up and down. If we go more than 5 or 6 minutes, he gets nervous. But other than that, I would say the show was pretty much the same.
Really?
Which begs the question, why do we need Berman? That egg timer would do, wouldn't it?
I've been asking that question from day one.
Tom and Ray Maliazzi recorded in 2001. We'll hear more of that interview in the second half of the show as we continue our tribute to Tom, who died yesterday at the age of 77. And we'll hear more from Car Talk's executive producer, Doug Berman. Here's another clip from Car Talk. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Dr. Mahis Munis told the annual meeting of the American Academy of Neurology that about 24 cases
of spontaneous French occur every year. Come on, snap out of it, will you? You're on National Public Radio. Get a hold of yourself, boy.
It's too close. I can't see anyone.
Come on, you can do it. Come on, you started it, you finish it.
24 cases of foreign accent foreign accent syndrome.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Our show today is a tribute to Tom Maliazzi, who died yesterday at the age of 77 of complications related to Alzheimer's disease. Tom and his younger brother Ray were the hosts of NPR's Car Talk, which is still broadcast in an archival version. The brothers gave car advice on the show, but the show also became famous for the brothers' comedic banter and philosophical asides. Before they got their start on radio, Tom and Ray opened a car repair garage, which is still operating and is owned by Ray. Let's get back to the interview I recorded with Tom and Ray in 2001. We'll pick up where we left off in the middle of a laugh. When you started on radio, did anyone ever say to you, Tom, Ray, you're laughing too much. You know, you have to be more serious. Tone it down.
Terry, no one ever told us anything. we until maybe a week ago, we would walk into the studio and say, are we on? I mean, we had absolutely no information. We knew the room we would go to. We knew where to sit. And that was it.
And that's pretty much the reason we knew that is there was a show on the hour before us called Shop Talk, which was two or three guys talking about stereo equipment.
Yeah.
And, you know, recording and the like. And we would watch them through the glass, and we would see how far away from the microphone they sat, and we noticed that they wore headphones, and we noticed that they pressed the lighted buttons on the phone to talk to callers. And so we patterned ourselves after what they did.
And I'm proud to say that after 23 or 4 years on the radio, we have learned absolutely nothing. I know, and it's absolutely the truth. I mean, people say, tell us about radio. We have no idea. We sit in front of the microphones here. We know nothing about radio. Nothing.
We've never made any attempt to learn anything either. And we do laugh a lot, too much sometimes, and I'm sure people complain. And there are
plenty.
Many people who can't stand us. Because
my wife is one of them.
My brother laughs so much, especially. Right. Well, that goes without saying. Which wife?
All of them.
So when you started doing the radio show, did it change the business at the garage? Were more customers coming? Did they treat you differently because you were on the radio?
Well, one of the reasons that we did the radio show, we did it. I mean, when they asked us to continue doing it, we did it for no money. And why would we do that? And the only reason we did it was we were able to mention the name of our garage on the air. And that was the only reason we did it. And we did it until like a month ago for no money. As long as we could mention the
name
of the garage.
That's a real long month, that month ago.
Yeah. So we mentioned the name of the garage. And yes, business did pick up because people had heard of us.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was the reason we initiated the puzzler on the show, because we asked people to send the answers to the puzzler to the garage.
Yeah, because they told us we could not plug the garage, so we devised this clever scheme of a puzzler, and then we said, and if you have an answer to the puzzler, with which, if you win, you could win a free oil change, mail it to, and we gave the name and address of the garage.
So you still have the garage. Ray, you still manage the garage. Tom, you don't really work at the garage anymore. So
I don't work at the garage. I decided that it was too much work, and I...
Plus, we have a restraining order.
I think it's 500 feet now. I can't go within 500 feet of the garage. Yeah.
How have you each liked over the years having responsibility for a business, for making sure you make a profit, making sure the customers are treated okay, for having responsibility for employees?
Oh, I hate it. It's incredibly stressful.
No, that's part of the reason I left.
Mm-hmm.
It was horrible. Mm-hmm. No, it was horrible. I mean, we had to fire a guy once, and it broke my heart. Leo.
Yeah.
I mean, he was our buddy, and he was such a screw-up, it was unbelievable. And he was so unreliable, it was hopeless. And he even said, he came in one day, he said, I want you to fire me. And we couldn't do it, because he was our pal. And Jerry,
yeah,
same thing.
Yeah, no, it's tough. And it's
horrible.
And it's tougher, however, I think, having responsibility for the customers' cars. Because you're responsible you're responsible for people's safety. You have to make sure you put all the pieces back and their wheels don't fall off and their brakes work.
Well, I was just laughing at the memory of the one that you took real good care of, the Nissan. The one that took the plunge.
I did have a car fall off the lift.
Oh, God.
One day, and I don't know how it happened. But
that's every
and the guys at the shop have never ever let me forget it. Every time a Nissan comes in, they ask, "Would you like us to put the thing up on the lift for you, or do you think you can handle it?"
How loud was it when it fell off the lift?
It was so loud that people from every surrounding building came running over to see what had happened, and I stood there and laughed and laughed. And the reason I laughed is, but for a few seconds, I would have been under this car when it fell off the lift, because I had walked over to my toolbox to get a wrench. And as I turned around, I noticed that the car was at a peculiar angle and no longer parallel to the floor. And I said, And I didn't have much time to think about it. And 6 feet to zero happens very quickly.
Oh.
And within a wink of an eye, this car was on its side.
What did you say to her?
It was an interesting call.
It had to.
It was a fellow whose name I don't remember, who owned the car, and I told him that there had been an incident.
Yes, I would say so.
And his car had fallen off the lift, but again, I was giddy because I hadn't been under it. And I told him that. I said, "Look, we'll replace your car, or the insurance company will replace it, or whatever. But I'm just so happy that I wasn't crushed by your car." He was not amused.
He wasn't?
No.
What was your first fender bender?
Jeez, my first fender bender. Oh, I remember my first fender bender. It was with my dear friend Johnny Mellum, a friend of mine who had a car, and I was in college at the time, because in high school I was too young to drive a car. No, I was in high school. And he had come to my house in his car. And again, it involved a door. I'm bad with doors.
Evidently.
And he was pulled up alongside me somehow. And I didn't realize he was getting ready to leave. And I opened the door of my father's car. Johnny pulled away, and the door and his car met. And it was ugly. It was ugly.
Well, I don't remember my first accident, but I can tell you about my most recent accident.
It was this morning.
No, I had the great pleasure a few years ago of buying for myself, from a customer who had melted the engine, a 1987 Dodge Colt Vista. And even then, which was 3 or 4 years ago, it was an old jalopy. And not that I'd always had nice cars, but I always tried to, even if I had an old car, keep it looking good or in good shape. But with this car...
I never took the trouble.
With this car, I decided that it was a jalopy from the start, and it was going to remain one. I wasn't going to fix the dents or the rust or anything.
And you realize how liberating that is.
It is unbelievably liberating. And my accident occurred one night as I was driving home from work. I was in Harvard Square, and a woman driving a Honda evidently wasn't paying attention and smashed into the back of my car. jarring, you know, me out of the driver's seat almost. But I wasn't hurt. And instead of the usual where you'd get out of the car and exchange papers, I rolled down the window and stuck my head out, and I asked her, she was also driving a jalopy, if she was okay. And she said, yeah. And I just waved and said, see you later.
Forget about it.
And I drove off. And that's the first car I ever would have done that with. And it felt great. And I've
done that with every car I ever owned.
I didn't look until days later.
It didn't matter.
I realized that she had ruined my car. No, and it didn't matter. Isn't it crazy that we have cars that are all shiny and polished and ripple-free and dent-free, and we have to worry about them? You buy a new car, you can't go to the parking lot for 6 months afraid that someone's going to dent your door.
Well, were you ever that way with a car?
Yes, I was once that way with every car. And I realized one day how stupid it is.
It's only a car.
It's only a car. It's absolutely nuts. And I think we there are certainly more important things to do with our time and our lives.
Like fixing the cars.
Well, whatever, but you know, there are certainly more things to be concerned about than the finish on your car.
Now, a lot of people think of you as Tom and Ray, you know, and they're not always sure which is which. It's like Tom and Ray, they're the car guys. So let's talk a little bit about who you are both as individuals. There's 12 years age difference between the two of you. Tom, you're 12 years older than Ray. Were you close as kids? It's a really big gap when you're young.
Well, you know, in between, there's a sister. And she claims that she has no recollection of my little brother for the first, like, 15 years of his life. She claims that we were the only two siblings. And she said, where the heck did he come from? But, I mean, we were close in if a 12-year-old can be close to a no-year-old, and a 20-year-old can be close to an 8-year-old,
I'm glad he got that right.
So I guess we were close because I remember him fairly well, you know.
Tom, did your mother make you take care of Ray?
I don't think so.
No, because
I thought it was fun.
Grandma lived with us.
Yeah,
our mother's mother lived with us, and she took care of all of us for a time. It was her, I don't know if it was her responsibility, but or she just enjoyed it. But she took charge of us, and she was the one who, when she went to do the shopping, took the kids along and whatever. And we don't know what Mom did.
Yeah,
what did she do?
Ray, did Tom bully you as the older brother, or was he too old to bother?
Oh, no, not at all. He was too old to bother, and we had a great relationship. But I do remember going places with him and his friends. You know, why a kid who was a senior in high school would want to take his little brother to the beach with them, I don't know, but I willingly and gladly went along.
Well, I have to let you know.
Oh.
They were paying me off.
I thought so. I thought so.
I was making 20 bucks a week. Back then, that was big money.
Ray, did Tom expose you to things that your parents didn't know you were getting exposed to that they might not have been pleased about?
Like dangerous chemicals and the... No, no, not really. No.
No, I mean, the memories I have is we went to... get this. I take my little brother to see in person the Three Stooges. Wow. Do you remember that?
I mean, I do remember.
Talk about memorable.
I remember it. You also took me to see Benny Goodman at Symphony Hall.
Yes, I did.
Yeah. And he also used to leave me places, Terry. And that's how I learned my way around the subway system of our fair city.
Yeah,
you can get home from here. I don't want to.
Don't take it personal.
I'm only nine.
were either of you more sociable as kids?
Was one of us more sociable than the other, you mean?
Yes.
Beats me.
Geez, I don't know. I think Tommy was probably more sociable.
Yeah, but I mean, some of the happiest years of my life were high school.
All 6 years of them.
All 6 years of high school. So I don't know if that would be sociable, but it was a very sociable time.
Now, who taught each of you how to drive?
Dad.
Yes.
Yeah. In fact, my father, when I was a kid, he had a very old, even then, 1932 Chevy. And I was fascinated with driving. I remember I was 11, 12 years old, and I was watching him all the time. And it wasn't a simple thing to do. I mean, there was clutch brake. The starter was underneath the gas pedal. It was very confusing, and it wasn't like a modern car. And one quiet, beautiful Sunday, spring Sunday morning, we were driving down a street on the backside of Cambridge. It was pretty deserted, and he turns to me. I'm 12 years old, and he says, "Do you want to drive?" I almost peed my pants. Man, I was so thrilled.
And to this day, he has the same reaction. Someone asks him if he wants to drive.
Well, I got behind the wheel, and I did it. I mean, it was amazing. I stalled it a couple of times, and I was actually able to drive. I was so thrilled. And from that moment on, I just couldn't wait to get my license, which led to another incident.
What?
Because one day, I figured he had let me drive, so I now was a driver, you know? And one day, we were getting ready to go on a little family outing. It was a Sunday morning. The car was parked in front of the house, and I decided I'm going to be a good guy. We were loading up the car with stuff. You know, we were going to the beach. And the door was open. And I decided I would start the car and warm it up for Dad. And the car happened to be in gear, and I forgot to step on the clutch. And so I
became a three-door, huh?
I engaged the starter. The car lurches forward, and the door falls off. I mean, it had these big iron hinges, and they just broke. And there's the door lying on the sidewalk, and I'm terrified. Man, I said, oh, my God. My father comes out of the house, and he says, door fell off. He got some clothesline, tied the door back on, and we went to the beach. He never said anything about it. The next day, he took it down to one of his buddies, and they welded the hinges back together. But it was the incident. It's sort of like dropping the car off the lift, you know?
Was your father always that relaxed about things?
I guess he was.
Yeah, for the most part.
Yeah, he was.
Well, thanks so much for coming.
Terry, it's a pleasure.
Really enjoyed talking with you.
You're a wonderful person.
Thanks for inviting us.
Tom and Ray Maliazzi, the hosts of NPR's Car Talk, recorded in 2001. Tom died yesterday at the age of 77. Car Talk's longtime producer, Doug Berman, will tell us about his final visit with Tom last week after a break. This is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. We're remembering Tom Maliazzi, who hosted NPR's Car Talk with his brother Ray. Tom died yesterday at the age of 77 of complications related to Alzheimer's. This morning I recorded an interview with Doug Berman, who has been the executive producer of Car Talk since it became an NPR show in 1987. We heard some of that interview at the top of today's show. Let's hear the final part of our conversation. I always wondered, and I'm sure so many of their listeners wonder this, how do they manage to be funny every week using the same subject as the jumping off point? I know they talked about everything in the context of talking about cars, but still, like, every week it would be something about an engine or brakes or, you know, a corroding body. I don't understand how they could do that.
Well, I have the answer to that. And the answer is that they didn't have to be funny every week. They were funny every hour of every day, you know? That's really who they were. What you heard on the show was absolutely them. And when you finished the show and went to get a cup of coffee, it sounded the same, you know? I mean, the topics would change, but that's what they did. They sat down and they enjoyed themselves and they found humor in whatever was around them. And they made each other laugh and they made us laugh. So it was not an effort to be funny about anything. That's how they approached everything.
In all the public radio conferences I've gone to, I think I met Tom and Ray once. And I always understood that they didn't travel a lot, they didn't leave town much, they didn't do a lot of public appearances. How come?
Again, they were just sort of, they were internally driven. I can tell you a story that about how they, I can tell you a story that reflects his unique approach to doing what he wanted to do. and also can teach you something about negotiations at the same time.
Oh, I'm eager to hear this.
Yeah. One day I got a call from a woman who was some sort of talent representative, and she said, I'm calling about Tom and Ray. I'm representing a client, which is, I won't say the name of the client, but it's a major software company that makes a program called Word and one called Excel. she said, we're introducing a new product. I don't even remember what it was. Maybe it was something in your house that you open to let air in or something. And she said, we're doing this in New Orleans, and we're doing a mock late night TV show as our, presentation. And we'd like Tom and Ray to be the hosts of this for this, 45-minute product introduction. And we'll fly them first class to New Orleans. They could do it in one day if they like. They could stay overnight or however long they want, if they want to enjoy the city. Would they be willing to do this? And I said, gee, I don't know. I'm happy to ask them. She said, well, we can pay them $10,000. I said, okay, I'll find out. So the next time I saw them, we were meeting, and I told them about it, and they looked at each other and looked at me and said, Tom said, why do we want to do that? I said, I don't know. I just said I would ask you. He said, okay, I'll tell her you're not interested. So I called her back the next day, and I said, hi, I'm sorry, they're not interested. She said, what do you mean they're not interested? I said, well, they're just not interested. She said, well, what's their number? And I said, I don't think they have a number. I think they're not interested. She said, well, of course, everybody has a number. What's the number? I said, I they don't have a number. She said, all right, well, ask them if they'll do it for $25,000. So I said, all right. And so next time I saw them, I said, I explained it to them, and I said, she wants to know if you do it for $25,000. And they said, well, no, why would we want to do it for $25,000? We didn't want to do it at all. We didn't want to do it for $10,000. Tell her no. So I called her back, and she says, all right, will they do it for $50,000? And I said, I'll ask them. At that point, I was, I thought, well, who knows? Maybe they will, So I went, and they said, no, why would we want to do that? So I call her back, and she's incredulous. And she says, tell them to give me a number. So I said, I don't think they want to do it. She said, well, just, I can't tell my boss that. Just whatever it is, tell them to give me a number. So I explain this to him, and Tom says, all right, tell her that to get us to do this, she would have to give us $100,000 each. But then we wouldn't be able to do it because we could never work with someone who was stupid enough to pay us that much. So that's why Tom didn't go to conferences. He didn't feel like it.
He did
what he wanted to do,
What is the future of Car Talk going to be now?
We're going to rename it the Best of Car Talk because it's obviously no longer going to be any new material. But I really think that Tom's legacy is up there with people like Groucho Marx and Mark Twain. I think his humor will be enjoyed for generations to come. And I think people listen to the show because they enjoy having a visit with the guys. And since that still exists, we're going to continue to distribute the show as long as people want to listen to it.
Doug, any final thoughts about Tom Magliozzi that you want to leave us with?
Well, a couple. I mean, one is just that, his laugh was so great and infectious that it just made everybody around him feel better. It was such a gift, he had a way of making everybody around him feel good. And when you put him in front of a microphone, millions of people felt better. And I think that's a great legacy. The other thing I've been thinking about is how difficult it is to see him decline with Alzheimer's. He had such an incredible mind, mischievous and deductive and curious and, of course, hilarious. So it was really difficult to see him taken by that disease. And I saw his lifelong friend, Don Chalk, just last week. We were both visiting Tom, and Don was upset, and he said, to have a guy like this with this kind of mind taken by that disease is a double obscenity. And to emphasize his point, Don inserted an obscenity between double and obscenity. And I agree with him. To see a guy who had such a mind have his mind, slowly go is an obscenity. But we'll have, we're fortunate. We have so much of his life that he spent in front of a microphone that we'll get to enjoy it as long as we want to.
And thank you for that, Doug. Thank you for having been the producer since the start in 1987 and for documenting Tom and Ray and giving us them to continue to listen to. Thank you so much for sharing some of your thoughts about Tom with us.
Thanks, Terry. I'm really happy to have been on Fresh Air on your show to be able to talk about my friend. It means a lot. Thanks.
Doug Berman is the executive producer of Car Talk and was the founding executive producer of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. We send our condolences to Doug, Ray Maliazzi, and all of Tom's family and friends. We're grateful for all the advice and laughs Tom shared with us over the years. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.